I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled 5-4 last week that anyone arrested, even for a minor offense, can be strip searched when taken to a jail or prison. The case involved a New Jersey man named Albert Florence, who was arrested, strip searched twice, and held in detention facilities in Burlington and Essex counties. He was accused of not paying for fines involving an outstanding warrant, but it turns out he had paid the fine, but it wasn't listed in the state records. Florence sued, charging his privacy rights had been violated when he was strip searched. The court said that safety concerns at detention facilities took precedence over Florence's Fourth Amendment rights. Today in Radio Times, we debate Florence v. Board of Chosen Freeholders and discuss the implications of the Supreme Court ruling. And we have two lawyers who have joined us by telephone. Susan Hanna-Lask is a civil rights attorney who represented Albert Florence in the lower courts. And Susan Lask, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Great.
Let me introduce our second guest. And Eamon Joyce is a partner in the appellate group at the law firm of Sidley Austin that represented the Essex County respondents before the U.S. Supreme Court. And Eamon Joyce, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And Susan Lask, let me begin with you. And what was your client or Mr. Florence's reaction to the court ruling against him last week?
Well, he was disappointed. We sort of expected it in this climate of political affairs, but we did our best. It was a 5-4. It was the closest we could get.
This goes back to 2005 when he was arrested. Describe for our listeners the reason for him being arrested.
The warrant was for a fine they claimed was never paid. Court fine, but the fine was paid, and the warrant itself said to bring him to a magistrate, not necessarily a jail, but they kept him for 6 days in one jail, strip searched in prison, Burlington County, and kept him the seventh day at Essex, finally picked him up and strip searched him there.
And can you describe what he describes as the strip search?
In the first strip search in Burlington County was they bring you in. It's when you're processed, it's the initial processing. You're brought in, you're fingerprinted, you're photographed, and then you're brought to a shower room, they call it, where there's a curtain, but they don't shut it all the way, and there's an officer in there, and he tells you to remove all your clothes, run your fingers through your hair, open your mouth, stick out your tongue, turn around, put your arms out. You're fully naked within arm's length of the officer, and the curtain is not all the way closed, and then they have you take a shower with delousing soap while the officer is still in the small room.
Is there any touching? Was there any touching that took place?
No, there was no touching. There was a second search, which was more intrusive, which on the seventh day, he was finally picked up by Essex County, which is a much larger jail, prison. And basically, in Essex County, it's a group strip search of about 5 men standing there at a time. Obviously, they do it for efficiency reasons. They all strip, do the same thing, take off their clothes, run their fingers through their hair, stand within arm's length of each other and probably within arm's length of an officer in a big room where about 20 people are coming in and out, including other inmates, anyone could walk in and out of that room. And there's officers just sitting there, so there's a group of people watching this. And the more intrusive part is they squat and cough, which is the definition of a body cavity search in New Jersey.
He was also asked to, and I'm quoting here, manipulate his genitals?
Yes.
What does that mean?
They lift their genitals, spread their cheeks in front of strangers.
And he charged, and you argued the case, not before the Supreme Court, but before the lower courts, that his privacy rights had been violated. Based on what? And then we'll get to Eamon Joyce.
Well, for 25 years, we had a case called Bell versus Wolfish, or under the Fourth Amendment. There's a constitutional right to privacy. I'll go with the constitutional argument for you, the issue. Everyone has a right to privacy of their person, and it's a balance of the government's intrusion to the person's privacy rights. Does the state or the prison really need to, our argument was, really need to strip search this particular class of persons, which were non-criminal offenders. Okay, they weren't misdemeanors, they weren't felonies, they were basically people that failed to pay a fine. In Mr. Florence's case, no warrant really even existed. So we asked for reasonable suspicion to be the standard, which has been the standard and is actually the standard in the rest of the circuit courts right now. The reasonable suspicion means that the officers, before they would strip search this particular class of persons, they would have a suspicion, reasonable suspicion, that they were concealing contraband, drugs, or weapons on their body. And the way they would have that is maybe the person came in high on drugs. You could tell if a person's high. Okay, you pat them down. They go through a series of things, prisons. They're also supposed to have a commanding officer. They're supposed to fill out sheets. None of these things have ever been done in these two prisons. They don't fill out the sheets. They don't have the commanding officers. They were just doing blanket strip searches, and that's what we were arguing against. You just can't blanket strip search everyone that comes walking in. The 86-year-old grandmom that forgot to pay her registration, she gets brought in. Should she be strip searched?
Well, let me get Eamon Joyce in on the conversation. And the court ruled 5-4 against Albert Florence. What is the court telling us?
Well, the court ruled pretty narrowly here. I'd say one thing first. Ms. Lask had two claims. One, that officers shouldn't be able to tell inmates to take off their clothes at all when they are admitted to a jail facility. And the court rejected that proposition 9-0. The dissent rejected that claim as well. Then Mr. Florence himself had a different claim, which was he was directed to undergo a visual body cavity search, which included, as Ms. Lask said, spreading his cheeks and lifting his genitals. And the experiences of many of these facilities tell us that inmates, incoming inmates, often use body cavities or their genitals to hide contraband, whether drugs or weapons or things that on the street would be more innocuous, money or cigarettes, but in jail are contraband and can be traded as currency or can disrupt security. And the court realized that guards face a very difficult problem here. Their first imperative is to make sure that all inmates coming into the jail and all guards working in the jail are safe. And what the guards see, and remember, these are inmates being admitted to the general jail population. So the 86-year-old or the person arrested for a normal traffic ticket is typically being released on their own recognizance. Florence had an underlying warrant here, and that's why he was brought into the general jail population. And so guards face a difficult situation. Who presents suspicion and who doesn't? And the offense for which one is arrested doesn't always measure whether or not that individual has contraband. And the court recognized as much.
So you're saying, as far as the court was concerned, that anyone brought to a jail or a prison or some kind of detention facility, that they all should be treated the same, that they're all essentially suspects?
Well, from the guard's perspective, everyone is the same. You have to remember that the guard admitting these people into jail is not the person making the arrest. The guard may receive some background on the individual, prior arrest history and what have you, prior conviction history, but sometimes individuals plea bargain to different things and offenses look lower or less grievous than the crime they actually committed. And so the guard is just seeing a number of individuals, all of whom, in the guard's eyes, may present a danger. And if you think about an individual arrested and who's going to be committed, an individual who's arrested of a fairly low-level offense, Justice Kennedy's majority opinion recognized that that person actually may have the greatest incentive to hide contraband, to prevent a low-level offense from becoming a high-level offense, namely that they have drugs or a weapon. And so from the guard's perspective, he or she needs to do as much as possible to make sure that contraband doesn't make it into the facility in the first place.
Well, and I know you want to get it back in on the conversation, Susan Lask, but to you, Eamon Joyce, there were four dissenters, obviously, Justice Breyer, talking about these strip searches as an affront to dignity and privacy, especially for things like minor offenses. Does that resonate with you at all?
Well, I think all parts of the court recognize that no one wants to be strip searched. But the fact of the matter is here, we're talking about the jail context, and for nearly 60 years, the Supreme Court has recognized that the privacy rights in prisons and jails are greatly diminished. And the question here is this a greater affront than many of the privacy affronts we regularly experience in jail? And the fact of the matter is here, as our amicus brief showed, and as the party's brief showed, this is a 3 to 5 minute procedure where the individual is viewed nude and no hands are placed on the individual. And these are individuals who, once they're in the jail population, are viewed nude regularly in any number of activities, whether showering or using the toilet or what have you. And so none of us likes to think of ourselves as having to undergo a strip search, but we also don't like to think of ourselves as having to undergo the things one regularly has to undergo in jail.
Susan, last time we give you a chance to weigh in on that, your response.
Well, I got three. The general jail population, Mr. Florence should have never been there in the first place. Not everyone's supposed to go into the general jail population. In fact, he should have been brought before a magistrate immediately. He wasn't. And that big mistake and that negligence of both prisons, Burlington and Essex, tortured this man and will torture everybody else, by the way, if they keep doing this.
Let me just stop you there, only because torture is a very powerful, even loaded word. What you're saying, he was tortured? This
strip searched.
That's the same as torture?
I'm sorry, Marty, go ahead.
That's okay. I just want to, you're saying that being strip searched and forced to squat, that's torture?
I'm saying being brought in completely innocent and, you know, taken away. The circumstances he was taken was on a routine traffic stop that his pregnant wife was driving the car with his, like, 3-year-old son watching his daddy being taken away, and they had the proof that the fine was paid. He carried the receipt with him. And so the torture was he was in prison saying, I didn't do anything wrong. He was crying. He was begging to get out of there. His wife, for 7 days, was running around through the court system with that piece of paper, showing that her husband was innocent. You know, short of, you know, if that warrant was even correct, it's still outrageous to strip search somebody on a warrant to pay a court fine. But his circumstances were worse. Yes, I used the word torture. He was crying. He was a grown man. He just wanted out of there. Then they threw him in the general population. Well, that's interesting because Justice Alito, Justice Roberts.
Hold on to that thought, only because we have to take a very short break, and that's Susan Hannah-Lask, and also with us is Eamon Joyce, and we are talking about a Supreme Court decision last week about strip searches. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY. Do your drinking habits cause problems in your personal or professional life? Do you drink to cope with stress? These may be signs of alcohol dependence. UPenn is conducting a research study using naltrexone, an FDA-approved medication for use in treating alcoholism. If you are 18 or older, have an alcohol problem, and want to reduce your drinking, you may qualify for the study. Details at 215-222-3200, extension 170. 215-222-3200, extension 170.
We've heard about anti-gay activism in Uganda. Now the rhetoric is heating up in Liberia, and observers fear it could boil over into violence.
There needs to be some sort of action before it really spirals out of control.
But why this effort to target gays, and why now? We'll try to find out next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Kimmel Center presents the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields on Monday, April 16th in Verizon Hall. Led by violin prodigy Joshua Bell, this vibrant chamber orchestra presents a concert of works by Beethoven and Mozart, striking a delicate balance between fiery solos and dramatic ensemble playing. Tickets available at 215-893-1999 or KimmelCenter.org. The Kimmel Center supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. We are talking about a Supreme Court ruling last week that anyone arrested can be subjected to a strip search when taken to a detention facility. That's what happened to plaintiff Albert Florence, who was wrongly arrested for an unpaid traffic violation, which in fact he had paid. Florence was strip searched twice by two New Jersey detention centers. He sued both Burlington and Essex County detention centers, arguing that his Fourth Amendment rights had been violated when he was unreasonably searched. But the court ruled 5-4, deciding in favor of the jail officials, arguing that safety concerns at prisons and jails took precedent. That's what we're talking about today on Radio Times with Susan Hannah Lask. She's a civil rights attorney who represented Albert Florence in the lower courts. Also with us is Eamon Joyce, and he's a partner in the appellate group at the law firm Sidley Austin, representing the Essex County respondents before the U.S. Supreme Court. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Susan, you wanted to talk about an exception, and I guess this was written by Alito and another justice about strip searches for people being sent into the general population of a detention facility. Can you expand on that?
Actually, yeah, I apologize. I said Alito. I meant Justice Roberts. And, you know, the two concurring decisions that tried to smooth out Justice Kennedy's decision, if you read Justice Roberts, what he says is, well, apparently, you know, there wasn't any other alternative. You know, there was an alternative. You don't throw these people in the general population. Albert Florence should never have been there. And these people coming in at processing that are non-criminal offenders should never be thrown in the general population. There's just no excuse. What Mr. Joyce, you know, is missing or not explaining, and I was in this case for 6 years, and I did the depositions of the wardens right down to the, you know, supervising jailers and officers, is that their own rules said they were not supposed to do this. The jails had rules against exactly what they were doing to everyone. The reason what I discovered and what they actually said, even the officers, why they did these blanket strip searches is because it's just much faster. They don't have the time and they don't have the money to segregate the non-criminal offenders from the criminal offenders. So sometimes they throw them in the general population. There's also something Mr. Joyce said about, you know, well, these people will be brought to a magistrate. No, they're not. Often they're held for days beyond what they're supposed to. If they would be brought to a magistrate and the system would work properly, we could have avoided all of this. You know, then they could pay a fine and get out before they could be, you know, go through the inhumane treatment of a full strip search. And again, in the Essex County, you know, this is more than a strip search. It's a body cavity search when you start spreading your cheeks and they look in your body cavities and squatting and coughing and manipulating your genitals. I've talked to hundreds of these people, and they're all shell-shocked from the experience.
Well, let me turn back to you, Eamon Joyce. And I'm just curious, in the year 2012, now this, of course, happened about 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, but why does jails or detention facilities, why do they have to do a strip search? We can go to the airport and essentially have, you know, have a body scan and the TSA can figure out if we're carrying a weapon or not. Why can't this be used in a prison facility? Eamon Joyce?
Well, there are a couple issues there. First of all, nothing in this ruling makes any facility do a strip search, and not all facilities do strip searches. There are some facilities who have looked at what the contraband coming in is and have determined that a strip search would be beneficial. The scanners that you're referring to, first of all, are very expensive, and not every facility can afford them. Second of all, they miss things, specifically non-metallic objects. So weapons not made of metals, drugs often can elude the searching authorities.
Going back to Justice Breyer, and he seemed to indicate, and perhaps I can put this first to you, Eamon Joyce, which is, since these strip searches do happen on a regular basis at a number of detention facilities, has anyone been able to figure out how much contraband or even weapons are smuggled into these facilities, Eamon Joyce?
No, I mean, there hasn't been a systemic study. Justice Breyer refers to one district court case, which the parties disagreed about what the findings there showed. There is, what should be said is there's no dispute in this case or in the case to which Justice Breyer refers that these searches are effective. The expert that Ms. Lask hired in this case testified that having every individual taken into custody strip search would be the most effective way of keeping contraband out of the jail. In the case to which Justice Breyer referred, the plaintiff's expert testified that if he could, he would strip search every newly arrived inmate, regardless of what brought him or her to the facility, in order to minimize the risk of the introduction of contraband. And that's a big part of this, is the deterrence aspect. There were amicus briefs submitted in this case where people said at facilities where they knew they wouldn't be strip searched or viewed nude, they'd stick things in their bra, stick things in their underwear, because they knew they could escape detection if they were a certain level of offender. So it's a difficult thing to quantify when you have a deterrence aspect.
But I'm curious, Eamon Joyce, and this is not a constitutional question, but do you have some sympathy for Albert Florence? In part, he was taken to these facilities and apparently had paid this fine on an outstanding warrant.
Absolutely. The warrant issue is a bigger problem. Unfortunately, it's not. It's an issue of the New Jersey state government, not an issue of either of these counties at issue here. It's a state-issued warrant. The arrest was made by a state trooper, and I understand Mr. Florence's frustration. He shows the state trooper a document showing that it's been paid, right. But I don't think many people could question what the state trooper did. He looks in the computer, and the warrant in the computer, wrongly, shows unpaid, and it shows an outstanding warrant for hindering prosecution. If you dig one step deeper into that warrant, you see that Mr. Florence pled to hindering prosecution after being charged with assault with a deadly weapon and obstruction of justice. And so there's a big red flag on the file, erroneous though it may be, and the officer essentially is following orders, what the computer is telling him to do and what the state records are telling him to do. And then Mr. Florence gets to guards at two county facilities, who see that same warrant and see that they're supposed to be holding this individual, at least according to the computer systems.
Well, Susan, last time we give you a chance to weigh in on that, then I do want to get to some callers here. Is part of your defense of Mr. Florence is that he was not just strip searched, but he was actually innocent of the thing for which he was arrested?
Well, just one quick factual note. Our expert never testified that this should be done. There was a confusion in experts, apparently. We never hired the expert that they claim we did, but that wasn't even a matter anyhow. You can't – the experts never even went to depositions. With the – state troop. I'm sorry, Marnie, ask your question again.
Well, going back to this case, is your outrage, in a sense, or even your reason for defending Albert Florence, is that he was actually innocent of the thing of which he was accused? Also, the fact that an innocent person was being strip searched in these detention facilities.
Well, yeah, that was half the case. You know, the other half was the privacy rights. The prisons are held accountable because, again, I did see depositions, and I asked the question, well, why did you keep him? You know, why didn't you bring him to a magistrate right away, which is actually the law here in Jersey? And they said we were waiting for Essex to pick him up. So it's not a New Jersey state problem. It's the county's problem. They held him. they weren't passing the paperwork. I don't know what they did. They mm-hmm. say they fax it. They were waiting for Essex to pick them up. But they held him way too long. This could have all been avoided, actually.
He was in these facilities for almost a week?
Yes, 7 days.
And did he ask for an attorney during that time?
Yes, he asked for phone calls. They wouldn't give him phone calls. They wouldn't give him toothpaste. They wouldn't give him soap. They just mistreated him. They wouldn't talk to him. He begged one officer for quite a while until he, you know, was nice, and he said, here, make a call, and he called his wife. While he was begging to get out of there, his wife was running around that whole week looking for, help from the courts. And by the time he got to Essex, and they did bring him before a magistrate, it was immediately noticed that the warrant was a glitch, it was wrong, and they let him go, but it was after 7 days of pure hell.
And that's Susan Hannah Last. She's a civil rights attorney, represented Albert Florence. Also with us is Eamon Joyce. He's a partner in the appellate group at the law firm of Sidley Austin, representing the Essex County respondents. And we are talking about a case decided last week by the U.S. Supreme Court, a case called Florence v. Board of Chosen Freeholders. And the court ruled 5-4 that anyone arrested, even for a minor offense, can be strip searched when taken to a jail or prison. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. What do you make of or think of the Supreme Court decision? Give us a call at 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Tony from Princeton to join our conversation. And Tony, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
Morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm a journalist here in New Jersey, and I remember several years back going to one of the prisons here in New Jersey to view a new system that the Department of Corrections was testing, which was sort of an electronic chair that they could have an inmate sit in that would detect a foreign object in their body. And if this chair sort of raised a red flag, then they then would have cause to do a strip search. But it was sort of the first line of the checking that an inmate would go through as they came into the jail.
And the question, go ahead, Susan.
I can answer that. And
yeah,
you're correct. It's called a BOSS, B-O-S-S chair, and you're correct. Essex used it, Burlington didn't. BOSS stands for body orifice scanning, and I'm going to guess the last S is system, but you're absolutely correct, and they did use that. And should be able to detect anything, you know, metallic or any kind of contraband, but possibly not. You know, the argument's going to be from Mr. Joyce, weed or, drugs.
Well, let's find out if that is the argument. Go ahead, Eamon Joyce.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the BOSS chair, first of all, Essex has used it, I believe, only since 2006, and Mr. Florence's arrest occurred before then. And the testimony in this case was that it does have that limitation. It really is only going to pick up metallic items. It's not going to detect any illegal drugs or any non-metal weapons. People who've regularly been in the jail system know that prisoners can make knives out of plastics and resins and what have you, and they don't need to be metal.
Eamon Joyce, I'm curious about what you think the implications or the impact of this Supreme Court decision will be. Do you think there will be more strip searches in detention facilities?
Well, I think there will be some facilities that have stopped strip searching that might go back to it. In the case that Justice Breyer referred to in his dissent, a case from the Southern District of New York, that court had talked about how Rikers Island had done strip searches on everyone being admitted there, that's the New York City jail, until the appeals court presiding over New York and the other federal jurisdictions here outlawed the practice, and maybe a place like that goes back to it. There are also plenty of jails and prisons in jurisdictions that just haven't chosen to do this. They don't see themselves as having a contraband problem, or they see the strip search as too labor-intensive, and those places probably aren't going to change one way or another. The other thing I'd add is the court's ruling doesn't prevent states from going further. that is from outlawing strip searches except where certain conditions are met. New Jersey's law at the time that this case was litigated was unclear. The parties disagreed about whether New Jersey law allowed the strip search. But subsequently, there are arguments that New Jersey law is clearer and doesn't permit a strip search. Other jurisdictions, I think Justice Breyer points to a number, don't permit the strip search except in where other factors are met. And those jurisdictions obviously aren't going to change because it doesn't help to have a constitutional rule that protects you if someone can still sue you for violating state law.
And Susan, what do you think, Susan Lass, what do you think the court ruling, the kind of impact you think this court ruling will have?
I agree with Mr. Joyce. It's going to be up to the jails and the states if they want to change anything or not. A lot of jails literally said, you know, we're not going to strip search. You know, they're going to stick with their policies that they have in place now. You know, what it says, that decision basically it kind of leaves it open, and it basically says, well, I see it as narrowed down. If they're going to the general population, then, you know, yes, it doesn't violate their Fourth Amendment rights. Justice Kennedy found, you know, the greater good in the general population as opposed to, you know, one innocent man against 12 guilty.
Well, Eamon, we have a couple minutes before our second break here, but the court also made reference to Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bomber, basically saying that he was arrested, actually, I think after he set the bombing for having a license plate problem on his car. One of the 9/11 terrorists was stopped, ticketed just a couple days, I think, before the hijacking of Flight 93. And the court says here, people detained for minor offenses can turn out to be the most devious and dangerous criminals. The implication being that if somehow they had been arrested, that would have prevented these terrorist attacks. Does that make sense to you?
I don't think the majority was going that far. I think that passage is somewhat flawed, but it gets at what I was talking about earlier. From the guard's perspective, the arresting offense doesn't always match up to the level of danger presented. And you can think of that in any number of ways. The police may arrest on a fairly low-level offense while they build evidence to make a greater case. You can think about Al Capone being arrested on tax evasion when he was obviously taken off the street for far greater misdeeds. And I think that's just the principle that the court was getting at.
Well, let's take that very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about a Supreme Court ruling last week that anyone arrested, even for a minor offense, can be strip searched when taken to a jail or prison. As I said, it was a close ruling, 5-4. We're talking with Susan Hannah Lask, and she's a civil rights attorney, represented the Albert Florence, whose case was taken before the U.S. Supreme Court, and he was strip searched twice by two New Jersey detention centers, and charge that his Fourth Amendment rights had been violated when he was, quote-unquote, unreasonably searched. Eamon Joyce is a partner in the appellate group at the law firm of Sidley Austin, representing the Essex County respondents. Kind of a complicated mouthful there, but we are talking about strip searching today on Radio Times, or strip searches, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY and is committed to delivering comprehensive care in an environment where respect, compassion, and quality come first. To learn how they help make lives better every day, chestercountyhospital.org.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. You can receive tax deductions for sustaining nonprofits across southeastern Pennsylvania. The Philadelphia Foundation works with financial advisors and administers donor-advised funds, charitable gift annuities, memorials, and scholarships. The Foundation takes care of all the details, making it easy for you to make a difference forever. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philofound.org.
Recently, an airline pilot went berserk in midair, and a U.S. soldier allegedly went on a killing rampage in Kandahar. These acts muddle our understanding of human behavior and leave us confused and searching for answers. What causes an assumed good guy or regular people to just lose it? I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, some insights into why people snap. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
Bryn Mawr Trust supports WHYY. I'm Frank Leto, Executive Vice President at Bryn Mawr Trust. We have helped individuals, families, businesses, and institutions manage their wealth since 1889, and we're right here in your own backyard. Details at bmtc.com/wealth.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, and we're talking about the constitutionality of strip searches with our two guests, Susan Hannah Lask and Eamon Joyce, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Lawrence from Southampton to join us on Radio Times. Lawrence, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead.
Okay. My comment was that, unfortunate as it was for Mr. Florence, it was a breakdown in communication. I'm a former state corrections officer out of the state of New Jersey. And once the state corrections officers get an individual, they are going to strip search him because, just like one of your guests said, because of the introduction of contraband into the prison facility. See, here's the thing. Drugs, weapons, phones, those are a big danger in the facility, and yes, they do make their way in there. I heard somebody make a comment about a chair. We do have that chair, but it only detects metal. It doesn't detect substances or anything like that. It only detects if someone has a metal object somewhere in their body or on their body. So, yes, we do have to strip the individual to make the facility not only safe for the officers, but also safe for an individual like Mr. Florence going into the facility to make sure that he can make it back out in case of mix-ups. But the breakdown in communication I was talking about was the individual, whoever keyed in the information to issue an arrest warrant for him, doesn't talk to the state trooper. All the state trooper does is get the information and acts upon it. The state corrections officer only gets the information that we have an individual coming into the facility. Once that individual is into our custody, we have to act appropriately to make, I say, the area safe. And that's my comment.
No, it's a great comment, Lawrence, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Susan, let me give you the first chance. Go ahead.
All right. They have Attorney General guidelines at the time that existed and still do exist. And if you recall, I had the five New Jersey Attorney Generals amici that said, we do not agree with this. These are not our rules. There are rules they're supposed to follow. For the particular class of persons that are coming in, which were non-criminal offenders, the rules of the prisons and the Attorney General guidelines stated that they should not be strip searched at all. You must have reasonable suspicion first. So they were breaking their own rules for years, and that's what we were saying. I mean, for God's sakes, they had their own rules out there. They knew it was wrong.
But Susan,
place, and manner for everything when you talk about constitutional rights. It's a balancing again. And it's this particular class of persons which are at the processing stage coming in that shouldn't necessarily be thrown into the general population in the first place. I'm sorry, Marty.
No, that's okay. But Susan, with this Supreme Court ruling, will that change then the guidelines in New Jersey from your perspective?
It doesn't have to change. It probably will stay the same. Who knows what will happen in a couple of years from now. You know, again, politics seems to rule the roost around here.
Well, Eamon Joyce, do you want to add to that or respond to that?
I mean, we disagree on what state law required at the time or forbid at the time, but in terms of what Lawrence said, his comments sounded a lot like the jailers I spoke with when we went through and toured the facility at Essex. These are not individuals who are chomping at the bit to be strip-searching individuals. I can't say anyone we spoke with would list it among their favorite parts of the job or even something they liked about the job generally. Rather, they view it as something that's necessary to keep inmates safe and to keep themselves safe. And as the majority and the dissent both recognize, jails in the United States can be very dangerous places, and as experts across the board in these cases recognize, contraband just makes the job more difficult.
Let me get Lawrence. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Bernie from Center City, Philadelphia, has to say. And Bernie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I'm always surprised, or maybe not surprised, but frustrated when I hear of such cases where there was some official mistake or misconduct, and the person responsible for that official mistake or misconduct is never held accountable. In this case, as even the police officer who called in recently noted, somebody keyed it in wrong. Well, that's a major mistake, and it caused this person to have a week of hell. But is that person who made that official mistake ever going to be held responsible? And if they are, shouldn't they be held personally responsible, out-of-pocket expense, as opposed to the taxpayers having to pay the judgment if a court ever rules that the government really did err? Why do the taxpayers always have to pay instead of the person who works for the government who really made the mistake?
Susan, do you want to go that far?
Yeah. Well, actually, we're that's the next phase of the case. And also, don't think it's always the taxpayers. Actually, these jails and prisons have insurance companies, and they do step in.
The public pays the premiums for those insurance policies. So ultimately, the public still has to pay out of pocket for the mistakes of the government officials. It's always a diversion of responsibility or a diversion of accountability to the public. When the public did not make the error, the government officials make the errors.
Well,
and it's always diverted to the public.
Well, Bernie, let me see what Eamon Joyce says to your comment. Eamon, do you want to sign on that?
I would just say that Ms. Lask has prosecuted her case the way she's prosecuted it. She didn't name any state officials. She didn't name the state government, and she didn't name anyone, any individual employee in state government. Rather, she just named the two counties as defendants. And so while there is likely to be a next phase over the false arrest claim, from our client's perspective, and it sounds like Bernie's perspective as well, the people who directly led to the warrant error just aren't at the table here.
Should they be?
Actually, they are. We named the John and Jane Does, and in the discovery, certain names came out. People are named, but we still hold Burlington and Essex accountable. It's the prisons. Once he was put in, the question is, why did they keep him in for so long? Why didn't they bring him before a magistrate? Once he was under their possession, they had an obligation to take care of him, according to the warrant.
But that's different from what the Supreme Court ruled about strip searches.
Exactly. Yeah, we're talking about strip searching here today.
No, that's fair enough. And Bernie, thanks for the call to Radio Times, and you can call as well 1-888-477-9499. Eamon Joyce, let me go back to you. So what is I guess an unreasonable search? If everyone coming into a detention facility is strip searched, as the court essentially said last week, is there a moving definition of what's an unreasonable suspicion or a reasonable suspicion?
I think it would be in the gravity of the search is where the calculus would likely change. The court didn't pass on and didn't have to pass on any physical body cavity searches, and those weren't at issue here. And I think jurisdictions universally or across the country require a greater level of suspicion before anyone lays a hand on an inmate. I'm sorry, Marty.
No, that's okay. But it does end up treating people who are, even beyond this particular case, Albert Florence, but someone that is brought in for a nonviolent violation of some sort, it treats them just the way it would a mass murderer.
Well, not exactly, in that most of the individuals arrested on nonviolent offenses or traffic offenses or what have you never see jail at all. They're taken to, say, in this case, had Mr. Florence been picked up and there were no warrants, he would have been taken to the state police barracks and then released, given a summons to appear. What was different here is that there was this underlying warrant. And so it's only these category of offenders who are charged with a crime of a certain severity or have previously failed to appear for a summons or have an outstanding warrant that actually make the jail population.
But using this case, and you can't say this is true of all people, but we're seeing, you know, pretty serious glitches and communication problems within the system so that an innocent person ends up being held in a facility.
Right, and if Ms. Lask or another plaintiff can make out the claim that an individual was falsely arrested, then their damages could still flow from that claim. What the court has said is in a case where there is an arrest that's proper, facially proper, that is, the guards have someone that they are allowed to detain from their perspective and detain in the general population, then they can search that individual.
Susan, in hindsight, since the Supreme Court ruled against your client, do you think you should have settled earlier?
There was no settlement. They never were going to settle. In fact, their insurance companies did a lawsuit against them to decline any involvement. So there was, you know, Essex was claiming they were broke, and their own insurance company did a declaratory judgment action against them. That's on public record in the federal courts.
Let me get, looks like Mark from Newark, Delaware, to join our conversation. And Mark, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
I was wondering, I keep hearing the justification for this, if I'm hearing you right, is the safe work environment for the prison and for the prison guards and also the environment in the prison.
Yes.
Why is it that supersede the rights spelled out in the Constitution? I guess it's the Fourth Amendment. It sounds like a search and seizure violation. The burden shouldn't be the burden on the employer to provide this environment, the safe work environment, without violating the constitutional rights of the citizens. I mean, it seems like an imbalance. And that could change, but if they can provide a safe work environment, then they won't violate the rights. I think they should be able to, not violate the Constitution and provide the safe work environment for their employees. It's not the problem of the citizens.
Well, Mark, this was, and I appreciate the call because this was the argument before the U.S. Supreme Court. Eamon Joyce, you want to respond to his concerns?
Sure. There are a couple questions bound up there. I mean, I think one of the answers is it's not just the safety of the workers. It's the safety of the inmates. San Francisco, for instance, in its case presenting this issue and then its amicus briefs before the court, showed a minor offender that had come in who then tried to kill himself with razor blades that he was able to smuggle into the prison. And so you're not just looking at contraband for the traditional law enforcement reasons. You're really looking to keep inmates and the workers safe. And then in terms of the burden issue, that's a more difficult legal one. But since 1987, in a case called Turner v. Safley, which the Supreme Court applied in this case, the Florence case, the Supreme Court has put the burden on the plaintiff to show unreasonableness, where a penal institution comes forward with a reasonable explanation of why it has a certain policy, then the burden shifts to the plaintiff to demonstrate that the policy is unreasonable despite the penal institution's claim.
But is that a shift of responsibility?
It is a shift of responsibility, but it's one that the courts recognize for, you know, three decades and just applied again here. And even cases before Turner v. Safley, if you look back at the Bell v. Wolfish case, which Ms. Lask mentioned earlier, it's a case from 1979, the court had started shifting the burdens to the plaintiff to show the jail's or the prison's conduct was unreasonable.
Go ahead, Susan Lask.
Different, again, constitutional law is based against the balancing of the governmental intrusion against the citizen, and then there's a time, place, and manner of doing all of this. And my point is, you know, when they're coming into the jailhouse doors, your constitutional rights do not stop there. If you're coming in as a felon or a misdemeanor, yes, okay, you know, in the middle of a drug deal or something like that, I think the reasonable suspicion to strip search somebody at that point is just there. You know, it's beyond reasonable suspicion. But if you're coming in with a broken taillight or a failure to pay a warrant, I'm sorry, but to me, that's the next step is, you know what, we're going to fail to pay our phone bill, we're going to be taken, you know, get a collection against us, we're going to be brought into jail for the, you know, collection, and we're going to get strip searched. I mean, this does not warrant, again, an 86-year-old mom, grandmother being strip searched. Doesn't warrant anybody's children being strip searched for minor offenses that are not criminal. So the time, place, and manner of this whole case was all about these people coming in at processing, where, by the way, you know, in the decision, you know, they mixed some things. They said, oh, well, we had to look for lice. That's, you know, we had to look for MRSA. That's the nurse's job, which, by the way, is part of the processing. Then if you're concerned with that, then switch it up and let the nurses, let a medical official do a strip search, not a guard. A guard's job is, you know, something else, but not to, you know, strip search everyone blanket. And that's what we were fighting against, the blanket strip searching, to prevent the few innocent. Even if it's, you know, 10,000 nationwide, it's enough, you know, to prevent the humiliation and the segregation. They do not have to be thrown into general population. And by the way, there has not been any empirical evidence ever that this has been a problem. The cases show and the opinion shows that maybe in the Bull case from California and in Georgia, they found one or two cases where this happened.
And so does, with, yeah.
Like Mr. Joyce said, that they brought in razor blades. It's an over-exaggerated risk.
And unfortunately, we have to end our conversation. Susan Hanna, last thanks for joining us today on Radio
You're
Times.
Welcome.
And Eamon Joyce, thank you for joining us as well.
You're welcome.
You're very welcome. Nice to have you both on the show. And you can go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscone. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.